One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
My podcasts often deal with distressing situations which are not suitable for children, and some adults for that matter. Some of what I discuss may trigger uncomfortable emotions. If that does occur, please reach out to Lifeline, Beyond Blue, or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Hello, I'm Narelle Fraser. I was a cop with Victoria Police for 27 years, 15 of those as a detective, having dealt with all types of crime from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. I witnessed the effect crime has on all those involved and became one of those victims myself in 2012 when I was diagnosed with PTSD. However, out of adversity comes other opportunities like this. My own podcast. I still pinch myself, but thanks for listening and coming with me as we explore the human side and impact of crime.
You'd heard of things in the past, but you sort of think, I'm all right, that's not happening to me, I'm all good to go, and you push on. That's what we do.
Since acquiring a degree in civil engineering, specialising in traffic and structural engineering in his final years at university in 1986, Peter Bellion's goal was simple to him, but not to anyone else. He wanted to reduce the road toll. Peter joined Victoria Police later that year in 1986, and he quickly became an accident reconstruction expert, having spent most of his 30-year career measuring, photographing, reconstructing and providing expert opinion of sickening sights that most of us couldn't bear. He attended over 2,000 fatal car accidents and 20 police road deaths. You wouldn't be surprised to know that Peter's got an incredibly analytical, astute mind. Peter's one of the few men I know, in fact, I'll go further than that, he's the only man I know who's never forgotten a birthday, an anniversary, funeral, wedding, or 21st. But unfortunately, he also remembers minute details of so many of the fatal accidents he attended. But that brilliant mind played tricks on him. It made him believe that he could manage his daily tsunami of trauma, heartache, and grief. In 2007, he was initially diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, but it took many more years, many more fatal accidents for his PTSD to become chronic, to the point where he was ill health retired in 2016. Although Peter struggles with chronic psoriasis, he's heavily medicated, he has constant flashbacks, exercises constantly to try and rid himself of traumatic thoughts. Peter still manages to be there for others who are struggling with their own demons. And with the help and support of his family, he sees good in most days. And as he says, I love this, he says, every day above the grass is a good day. Thank you very much for your time, Peter, and welcome.
Good morning, Narelle. Thank you for having me along.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being here. So where does this passion for reducing the road toll come from, Peter? Like, it's obviously a subject very close to your heart.
So it sort of started when I was younger, at about the time, you know, getting licensed and all that sort of stuff, my neighbour next door, Brett, his dad was in the police force, and we used to sort of go for a bit of a drive around, and for some obscure reason, when we'd heard there'd been a road fatality or something somewhere on the news, we would go there, not straight away, but after it's cleaned up, and actually walk through and try and work out what happened. But I suppose the reality of it all actually goes back to when I was very, very young, as a 5-year old, and I used to get my matchbox cars and smash them with a hammer to see how they performed.
And how did they perform, your little matchbox cars?
not good with a hammer. So it just goes to show you that motor vehicle structures aren't infallible, and there's only a certain amount of energy that the car's structures are able to absorb. And people drive around in then thinking they're invincible at times, and they can be distracted, or they can be speeding a little bit, or they can not have their seatbelt on, or they can be a little bit drug affected. But in a split second, that can all turn very, very pear-shaped, and then you have that horrendous outcome of either a fatality occurring, which has a ripple effect of flying onto about 100 people at least, somebody is very seriously injured for the rest of their life and spent in time under significant rehabilitation where they need to learn to walk and talk again and be spoon-fed and being taken to the toilet and things like that. So, when I joined the unit, what was in the accident investigation section, the major collision investigation unit, there was in 1989 there were 770 people killed on our roads, and in 1990 that dropped down to 500, so there was 270 less deaths in that first year. Back in 1986 I did a final investigation project for my engineering degree, and that was a review of speed limits on Victoria's roads. And what I found out back then in doing that was that the police in their collision reports didn't actually record any information as to actual travel speeds involved. They'd record the speed limit of the road, but there was no information as to whether speed was a causal factor in the crash at all. And from my engineering background, you're right, analyze crashes and work out that you could work out speeds, and eventually we found out that about 30% of road trauma was at least excessive speed related, or traveling at an inappropriate speed for the environmental conditions present. So that report I did back in 1986, I also found out that the police were operating on a fairly high tolerance above the speed limit at that point in time before somebody would be intercepted for a speeding infringement. And that behaviour had to change as the crash rates were extremely high, and that really needed to change to bring down that tolerance. And the only way to do that initially was to bring in the speed camera program, which had the ability to deal with multiple offenders initially, but then the word gets around and behaviour changes. So back when the cameras were first introduced, there was about 88% of people that went past a camera site were above the tolerance threshold. But now if you look at prosecution rates on camera sites, it's less than 1%. So there's been a massive change in behaviour in regards to travel speeds on our roads, and that was certainly one of the main things that led to that 270 less deaths in that first 12 months of operations, from 770 in 89 to 500 in 1990.
So how did you get word out to the public? Like, that's a huge drop from 88% to 1%. So how do you get that message out to the public?
So in reducing road trauma, or reducing any risk or hazard, effectively, you know, you use the three E's, what's called the three E's. So one is education, one is engineering, and the other one is enforcement. So examples of that are, for example, engineering in terms of the road environment, better friction road surfaces, sealed shoulders, wire safety fencing off the side of the roads, or steel W-beam Armco barriers, safety fencing, energy absorption terminals at the end of those barriers, frangible type lighting poles. So if a vehicle slides off and hits one, it doesn't penetrate into the car, it just has a slip base on it or an impact absorber type. You know, in terms of the vehicle itself, you know, the additional safety features that have come along in terms of motor vehicles over the years. So, you know, we initially went, you know, seat belts and collapsible steering columns in the early 1970s. And then through the course of my work, you know, in 1997 in particular, I went over to Detroit, Michigan in the US, and found out about things like stability control and feet airbags and side airbags and all this sort of stuff. And that they've eventually, you know, frontal airbags, side airbags, stability control, seatbelt pretensioners, all those sort of things now are standard in cars, as well. Things like driver fatigue alerts and all that have made a difference. In terms, so that's some engineering examples in regards to the road and the car or automobile. In terms of you know, the driver, most of the time crashes are associated with human error. Human beings make mistakes, and what needs to happen there is the education role. So in terms of education, probably the main role player from what I saw was in my role was the Transport Accident Commission or the TAC. They had a lot of money to spend on advertising because it was in their interest to do that, because as part of your registration fee on your car, most of the fee is actually third-party injury insurance, which is TAC component rather than registration component. So they were, you know, keen to spend money on advertising to educate people, and then the public saw a number of ads from the TAC, and a number of those ads I featured in terms of, you know, speed reduction or the wipe off fire initiative, which started in about 1997, that aspect of it.
Oh, it's another world to me. It's fascinating, but, you know, the thing is that nearly everybody listening will be able to relate to what you're talking about, because most of us have cars, or most of us have, you know, been passengers in cars. So what you've done is an enormous accolade, really, because us being in cars, you have helped us, well, me, to live, and, you know, obviously a lot of other people. So in layman's terms, how do you reconstruct an accident scene? And I understand you've done years and years of a degree, and I'm asking you to say this in 2 minutes, but just for us out there that don't know a great deal about it, how do you reconstruct a scene?
Well, you sort of have to start at the very beginning and then go to the very end, or start at the very end and trace back to the very beginning, in terms of when you get to the scene of a collision. So you'll have the physical evidence that's on the road. You need to, you know, one of the rules of investigators that you'd be well aware, Narelle, is failure to search is failure to find. So you need to be able to search that scene properly to locate all the evidence. And fortunately, I've still got 20/20 vision and was probably one of the best ones at seeing black tire marks on a black road at night time for quite a few years. And that's a skill in itself, is actually being able to see that evidence under nighttime conditions. And, you know, not everybody's got the ability or the eyesight to actually be able to see all that. And then you've got to use special techniques to mark that evidence out, and with your crime scene numbers, and photograph it. So, you know, you go through that 7-point crime scene search, examine the scene, photograph the scene, measure the scene, collect all your exhibits, label all your exhibits. So that's all your evidence. In terms of our photographing, you know, fairly comprehensive photographs, basically walking you all the way through the scene, and then numerous photographs around the vehicle showing the outside damage and deformation to its structure, inside components, things like, how people were injured inside the vehicle, whether they hit the steering column, whether the seatbelts were worn, what evidence was shown on the seatbelts of them being worn, what injuries there are to the people, whether it be they go to hospital and you get a doctor's report detailing the injuries, or your ambulance report that shows where the person had injuries, or if somebody's unfortunate enough to lose their life in the crash, you know, there would be an autopsy report done with a detailed medical report detailing the type of injury. So, you know, you'd have that biomechanics of crash injury relationship where you would relate what you're seeing in terms of damage on the outside of the vehicle and the extent of that damage and the extent of force and the extent of velocity change back to the internal human collision as well. So, it's a fairly comprehensive task. In terms of measuring, we would use when I first started out, it was the old string line and tape measure and a compass.
Serious, are you?
No, correct. In 1990, we were still using the unit was using string lines, tape measures, and compasses, and you had to manually draw. You used a process of triangulation or right angle offset measurements written out on comprehensive notes with multicolored pens, and then you'd sit on a drawing board drafting up that plan of the crash scene for up to 2 weeks. You know, like I remember the first triple fatality I went to was in September 1990 at Blackburn Road and Ferntree Gully Road, where a family went through a red light on a Sunday morning and were hit by a gentleman driving a Ford utility. It was a carpet layer, and unfortunately three of the family were killed. And that scene took about 12 hours to measure up back then, and I spent probably almost 2 weeks on a drafting board drawing up the plan of that crash. There's having my engineering background, and which includes surveying, there was other tools available. So in 1992, the accident investigation section, we first went to what's called total survey station technology, which is basically a surveyor's theodolite that's got an extra component in it of electronic distance measuring. So it allows you to measure all the angles and the distances from a fixed location to every item that you want to locate, whether it be physical evidence from the crash or the road environment itself. That was initially a two-person operation, so one person operating on the instrument, the other person operating on a staff pole that had a reflective prism on it. You'd basically go around the scene mapping that out and doing your photographs. That technology then in about 1996 advanced through to what's called robotic operation, where you could actually do it as a one-person operation. So do your initial setup at the instrument site, and then you could actually drive the instrument from remote access via a keypad attached to a plate on the staff pole, and you would actually move around the scene and get the instrument to follow you and measure the locations that you needed to pick up. In the early 2000s, things like 3D laser scanner technology came on board, and that had the ability to do a 360-degree scan of a scene, 40 degrees upwards, 40 degrees downwards, and measure something like 720,000 measurement points or data points about a minute, and in that scan it would actually pick up color settings, black and white settings. So the black and white was good for nighttime stuff, color during the day. It would also pick up heat scale settings. So like if there was been a fire, or for example, you could pick up the area where were the hottest points if you were there soon enough. Even in terms of skid mark evidence, the air wing, for example, introduced forward looking infrared pods on the helicopters, on the Dolphin helicopters, and they've now got the Leonardo helicopters. But if they were monitoring a pursuit situation from above and had that on of a night time, you could actually see the skid mark evidence, white hot glowing from that each setting through the infrared. So, yeah, there's a lot of technology. You know, camera technology advanced. You know, we've seen how cameras have advanced over the years and the quality of photographs that you get and the ability to edit or improve with lighting conditions or sharpness to make things actually appear more visible to people looking at them, you know, whereas with the older technology wouldn't show things up as good. So, yeah.
So with all this technology that you're talking about, that must have cut down the time at a scene tenfold. Like, you know, you're saying 12 hours at a scene for, say, a triple fatality. So now with all that technology, if you had a triple fatality today, how long would it take for you to do that scene as opposed to 12 hours, you know, in the 1990s?
Well, obviously it depends on the type of vehicles involved. But, you know, if it was just, say, a two-car collision on a country road, you know, you could map that out in under an hour with the technology that you've got. Whereas, you know, previously that would have taken 12 hours to measure up. So the quicker that you're able to get in and measure and document that crime scene and get the road reopened too makes a difference in terms of road trauma reduction, because you know, if you've got a main highway shut, you've got other vehicles being diverted off onto secondary roads, and then you get people that, you know, ultimately get impatient and they do stupid things, or they tailgate, don't give themselves enough distance, and you know, they might be running late, so they make a lot of bad choices, and then you end up with a collision on those secondary roads. So, we were very aware of that, and in the work we did, and that's why, you know, the various technologies were upgraded to try and improve the efficiency, so that you get in there and get out, you know, as soon as you can.
Just before I go on to the next thing I want to ask you, I want to go back just the safety fences that are on our roads now. I've often wondered, how do you identify and why do you identify a certain area that has those, you know, what we call the cheese graters? Why, like, I look sometimes and think, oh, yes, there's a tree there, or there's a bit of a hill or something. How do you identify where to put those barriers?
Well, a lot of it comes down to available clear zones. So, for example, in a 100 km/h speed environment, a clear zone where 85% of people could recover, it's a lateral distance from the edge of the traffic lane, is 9 metres for a 100K environment. So if you've got narrow objects within that clear zone, either if they can't be removed, well, then you've got to put up safety fencing to change the situation. So if somebody did lose control, they don't often hit a pole or a tree, they would go into a very energy absorbing structure. I don't like the word cheese cutters, which a lot of motorcycles.
The minute I said it, I thought I shouldn't have. Yeah,
they're actually, you know, we did a lot of testing with Monash University over the years of the various types of barrier systems, and I've seen the effects of where a motorcyclist hits the steel W Armco railing rather than wire rope safety fence, and it's a lot more drastic outcome on the steel W beam than it is on the wire rope safety fence. And, you know, in terms of the ones that I went to, you know, there was one where the motorcyclist basically high-sided and went over the top of the fence and was struck by an oncoming vehicle. And then there was another one where they actually lost control and slid down on the road, and then the bike in tumbling sort of landed and crushed him. So it didn't have anything to do with the fence. So, yeah, because if you're looking to, you know, the impact forces for vulnerable road users, you need you know, for a limb or something to be cut off, you effectively need a 90 degree impact at about 100 kilometres per hour, you know, in a pedestrian crash for a lower leg to be severed off, which from the research I've done, it's pretty gruesome, but that's the reality of it. Whereas with those safety fencing, generally you've got people sliding off the side of the road, coming in at an approach angle somewhere between 20 degrees to 45 degrees. So it's more of a side swipe type incident. Yeah, so, yeah, they have done some improvements. The post structures are the more thing that, you know, people are likely to hit if they're, ejected from a motorbike. So, but better than going off into oncoming cars or narrow objects. So, yeah.
Is there anything at a scene that's ever really stumped you that you can't work out how it's happened?
I'll probably there was one particular scene, and eventually we worked it all out, but it took a bit longer than normal, and that was a triple fatality down at Warren Ponds, and it was about 1992, and I went to it with Sergeant Brian Worcester, and Brian unfortunately passed away. He not long after that had a massive heart attack and died, which unfortunately one of the three long-term effects of being a first responder or being in the military is with the PTSD, you also have the situation of things like Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease and bowel cancer. So they're long-term effects. And, poor old Bertie, he passed away from a heart attack not long after that. But that particular scene was there was a Volvo G88 prime mover cab over heading outbound away from Geelong with a flatbed trailer on the back, no load on it, and there was a car in front of it that slowed down to turn left. Coming the other way was a Falcon sedan with a couple in there, and then a B-double truck. B-doubles had only just been introduced onto the Victorian roads back then, so they're 62.5 tonnes or 62,500 kilograms maximum GVM, gross vehicle mass. So it's a lot of energy there. And at that point in time, it was 100 kilometre per hour road zone or speed limit there. So the unladen truck coming up on the back of the vehicle that would slow to turn left, it was unladen. When you brake heavily in a truck that's unladen back then, you're quite likely to get skidding occurring from certain wheels. What actually happened was in that particular instance, the trailer brakes were a bit out of adjustment, and which mean they didn't come on as effectively as they should have. And so what happened was the drive wheels on the prime mover actually locked up, and that sets off a what's called a jackknife situation that put the Volvo prime mover out on the wrong side of the road, sideswiped the car with the couple, the Ford, and that spun off the highway. And then the both prime movers then had a massive impact, so much so that it rotated the Volvo prime mover completely around beneath the leading edge of the trailer and just took the whole top of the prime mover off. And then the Kalari B-double, which was fully loaded with sand in both trailers, rolled over and went over onto the side. So that one in particular is probably one that, as I recall, took a little while, quite a while to work out what's going on. But you just got to go back to your basics and go through follow the pathways of the vehicles in, looking at everything attentively, look at the evidence on the road and look at the evidence on the vehicles and eventually you piece it together. And the other beauty that we've got now, and also even in that particular collision, was that we started to have onboard vehicle monitoring systems that would record speed and engine RPMs and, record whether brake switch sensors come on to indicate braking, and all those sort of things. And it, you know, in the later model cars, it's recording velocity changes in the front to rear direction and the left to right direction, and whether seatbelts were buckled in and whether stability control systems came in. So a very, very technical role. You know, not only the investigators from Major Collision Investigation Group, you know, statement takers and interviewers of suspects or offenders, they are very, very highly skilled in use of technical equipment, and, you know, documenting those horrendous scenes, which when you look at it, like in terms of your role, you know, when you were at homicide, you would be taking statements, doing investigations, listening devices, phone, whatever, search warrants. You know, we'd do all that as well. But in your role at homicide, you would have crime scene come out and document your scenes or and photograph. Whereas at Major Collision Unit, you're actually doing that all yourself. So you're probably getting that, even though you're going to a lot more jobs, you're actually getting a lot more exposure because you're right in amongst the nitty-gritty of it, you know, looking at all the detailed evidence. And unfortunately, one of the side effects of that is also the horrendous sights that you see.
And that I can't imagine, Peter. I really can't. So being so constantly confronted by deceased bodies, I suppose, and grieving friends and relatives, at what point did you start to think that maybe you weren't managing, or did that never happen?
I joined the job in 1986 and got to the accident. I was did general duties, southeastern suburbs, then into town for a bit, and then back out to southeastern suburbs and doing general duties on the van, and then went to the traffic operations group. And in that time, you know, I sort of showed an interest in going to the more serious collisions in the area to develop my skills and knowledge. And then that ultimately led to me going to the unit in 1990 and getting a position there. So from 1990, yeah, like I can go back to probably in the first shift at the unit, I can still remember I went to two fatalities in the first shift. One was a cyclist that was hit out at Cranbourne, and then the other one was a truck and car collision at Victoria Street and Exhibition Street in Melbourne. So that, you know, that's 30 years ago now. So, you know,
and that was your first shift. Like and a shift for those out there, the shift is generally 8 hours. So within that shift, you've gone to the cyclist and
car occupant killed by a truck at an intersection in town. Yeah. So that's just in the first shift. So, and then the very first police officer fatality I went to, who was off duty at the time, Senior Constable Peter Cannon, you know, that was at on the Hume Highway just south of Wangaratta on the 13th of July 1990. And unfortunately, Peter had a fairly high level of alcohol in his system, but, you know, when you look back on it and the knowledge I've got now, you sort of realise that, you know, there has been a bit of history at times of members off duty being involved in drink driving incidents. But when you look at it, it's what they're actually doing is trying to calm the anxiety associated with post-traumatic stress by using alcohol as a means, which is not ideal. In that instance, Peter went onto the wrong side of the road and hit head on into a truck. So,
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at UH1.com.
Obviously, there was never any particular note left, but that type of situation over the years, car head on into a truck, night time, free, you know, 100k speed limits, is a way where people that are, you know, are in the depths of depression and really struggling with, say, PTSD or any other mental illness, might use that as an option, unfortunately.
So going back to when I said about was there a time when you thought maybe you weren't managing? So that first shift
in 2005, 2005 probably was when I started to realise that. So it's 15 years at being in the unit. By then, obviously, you know, I've still got a pretty high level of resilience, probably more so than some. And it was around the 24th and the 26th of April 2005, and obviously got Anzac Day in the middle, and you know, and there's history of military service and on various sides of the family, but the 24th of April 2005 was when Tony Clark from Region 4 Traffic Task Unit was shot and killed by a mentally disturbed driver after an intercept. There was a struggle, and Tony's firearm in that struggle was seized by the driver that he'd pulled over, and then the driver shot and killed Tony, and then he went up the road and shot and killed himself. So then on the Tuesday morning, I'm sitting in the office. That was on a Sunday, and then on the Tuesday morning, I'm sitting in the office actually completing the crime scene plan, which was measured up using a total survey station back then, but yeah, annotating all the evidence and putting title blocks and then sending it off to the printer as part of the exhibit for the brief of evidence. When at 8:30 in the morning, we get a call to go to another police officer's crash, and that was Senior Constable Rennie Page up at around the 200k post on the Hume Freeway at Benalla. So, Rennie had pulled over a driver for speeding. He'd checked the speed of the car on the radar. You know, the radar, the speed of the car was still showing on the radar when I inspected inside Rennie's car. You know, still showing 126 kilometres per hour. He had obviously gone to the car that he had pulled over, and they're both in the emergency lane, you know, decided to issue a penalty notice to them, the driver. So he normally you would come back to the police car, write that out. So he'd actually written that out, gone back to the car. This is 8:30 in the morning, perfect conditions, sun's not an issue, nice straight road, marked police car. And, on returning towards the police car, walking along the safety corridor that we would do between, which is offsetting your police car to the car you got pulled over to offer you that safety corridor, a driver that had left Melbourne at about 6:30 that morning, that was the area store managers for some Aldi stores at Wodonga and Wangaratta, had left Melbourne at 6:30, and he's about 2 hours into his trip and effectively has what we call a micro sleep at freeway speed, which is 110, and drifts left, takes off the rear view mirror on the driver's door of the police car, and hits Rennie as a pedestrian at effectively freeway speed, 110 kilometres per hour, and that was it for Rennie. And so that, you know, pretty horrific injuries to Rennie. And so I actually did Rennie's body recovery, removed his equipment belt, removed the firearm, made the firearm safe, assisted the undertakers to load Rennie up onto the undertaker's trolley, and zipped him up. So that was when I first, you know, had difficulty sleeping. And I went and did a debrief with clinical support after that. But I thought, oh, yeah, that's it. You know, box on, keep going. So that was, what I know now is what was the first signs of what's called PTSD. I didn't have a clue what PTSD was back then, but I know lots and lots about it now.
I bet you do. Oh, gee, Peter. So going back to Tony and Rennie, so you attended both those scenes, is that right? And you did the reconstruction, the photographing, everything. Is that right for those two?
For Rennie, I did measuring and photographs. But for Tony, one of our other crews had gone out that morning, on the Sunday morning, and photographed and measured it, but, you know, you bring it back to the office and I'm looking at all that. It's just like being there, really. You're actually looking at all the evidence in the photographs and your and I'm doing the plan. So you've got a really good visual picture of it's just like being there, really. There's no difference.
And you said that you went for a debrief with clinical support. What was that debrief like? I don't mean this to sound the way it's going to, but were you honest with how you were feeling, or were you putting on a bit of a front? Look, it's just another job. It's terrible, but, you know, as you said, box on and on with the next one.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we do. It's sort of a thing where, you know, back then it. You know, you'd heard of things in the past, but you sort of think, oh, yeah, no, I'm all right. That's not happening to me. I'm all good to go. You push on. Yeah, that's what we do. That's what first responders, health workers, doctors, military do. And, as a young recruit or a young nurse or a young military personnel, you get to work through what's called your fear flight process initially, because your drill instructors or your instructors actually yell commands at you, fires your fight flight system up, and initially allows you to work and get through that particular incident. But then as you go to more and more events throughout your career, each time you respond to a new event, because of what you've seen from a previous event or your knowledge from the previous event, you are now more aware of more risks and dangers, and you've smelt more, you've heard more, you know, you've seen more, and that all then, all those things become part of your memory and your hippocampus of the brain. And eventually what happens with PTSD or the chronic PTSD that I've got is that, you know, the subconscious brain will remember when triggered by things like sights, smells, sounds, and then the amygdala in the brain that controls the fear flight goes, oh, yeah, I remember that. That's related to this incident. And, of course, when you went to that incident at the time, everything was go, go, go. You know, the lights and sirens going to the scene. You know, the adrenaline's pumping around the body, the heart rate's going faster. It's setting your body up to protect you from what you're about to go to or what you're about to see. Or what you're about to be threatened with, if in the instance of when I had a couple of shotguns and a few knives and stuff pulled on me. So what happens is in that subconscious mind, when you're asleep or when you're just resting and not doing some activity, the mind will flow back into those sort of events because it's in your memory. And next minute, you get that adrenaline cortisol dump into your body, and then you get the hippie shakes and the psoriasis and the elevated heart rate and the bloated stomach and the sweats and sweating under the arms and sweating through shirts and all these sort of things, so, which are the physiological reactions of PTSD.
I was just actually going to ask you, what were the signs that you experienced that you sort of thought, gee, this isn't right? So you just said then you were sweating profusely, you weren't sleeping. What other signs did you have?
Your bloated stomach. You know, initially waking up at back around about that 05, 06, I was waking at 3-4 in the morning and up out of bed, and you know, I was going off doing 10k runs and 40k bike rides before coming into work at 7 a.m.
So you know, why do you think you were doing that?
Oh, you've got all this adrenaline going through your system and trying to burn it off, I suppose. So yeah, and that's what it is. And yeah, so I can't actually go to the extent of that level of fitness that I was back then. Like, if I'd go for a bike ride with the boys on a Sunday morning, you know, there used to be a stretch called Under the Bridge from North Road and Douglas Parade down in Newport through to Francis Street and Hyde Street in Yarraville. And Matt My Ride, you know, I held the gold record on that just about every week.
Because you had so much adrenaline.
Oh, yeah, hitting 45, 50K speeds and because of the adrenaline going through. And when, if we go to a job in 18th of February 06 where the six teenagers were killed at Miles Street Cardross up near Mildura with the offender Thomas Tao, during the trial for that job, I had been off with the initial diagnosis of the PTSD from about September 2007, because that was a few months after the Kerrang rail disaster on the 5th of June 07. And, you know, I had a series of a number of trials and, yeah, basically found myself walking around the golf course on time off crying. And I thought, this is not right. And, mind you, went into the office that day with a uniform on. Boss could see that, the eyes were a bit red, and you know, that doesn't take much to work out somebody's been emotional or crying. And said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Well, not really. You know, I just need a bit of time out, I think." And but they actually put me onto work cover, so that was the first time on work cover, and I think I was off for 13 weeks back then. The main reason I came back, because I got a letter from the work cover insurers back at that stage saying that, oh, you're now back to 80% of what you're on. And having a young family, you thought, shit, buddy, how's this going to work, you know? Go get the family going, and you're the sole provider. So, you're about to try and get yourself back to work. So my return to work after that period was in seven shifts back from the end of week one through to week two, was giving evidence in three court cases. One of them was the one in regards to the 16 ages Kudalt Mildura, where I was in the witness box for 4 days. One of them was a double culpable hit run where a gentleman driving a Ferrari and a female passenger and a person in a Ford had decided to have a bit of a drag race out of the blue, and went, you know, they were side by side, a set of lights out east on the Warby Highway.
Sorry, you just said then they're having a race between a Ferrari and a Ford.
Yeah, it was FPV GTV, so it was
a Ford. I reckon the Ferrari might just, you know, edge out the Ford, wouldn't you think?
Well, it didn't. Yeah, in that situation, the rear tyres were a little bit underinflated on the Ferrari, and they've come up over the crest of a hill on a right-hand curve, and the Ferrari's in the right lane, which has got a slightly tighter turn radius than the outside lane, and Ferrari lost control at about 160 k's and sideways into a tree, and the car's completely disintegrated. So, yeah, so that was so I had, 4 days for the Tau trial in the box, Supreme Court. In the county court in regards to that matter that I just spoke about, and there was another neg caused serious injury head-on job from the Geelong Bacchus Marsh Road. So during the Tau trial, I experienced, like in the box I was all right, although underneath the tunic, you know, the armpits were very, very wet.
Oh, yeah,
But then would have the brake, and in the brake, one of the brakes in particular, I just started – like hyperventilating, and what the hell's going here? So Cripsy, who was the informant in the case, he made a phone call to clinical support and in one of the breaks, and then I spoke to the person from clinical support and they said, what's going on? I said, this is going on. They said, oh, you've got all this adrenaline. You need to go for a walk or a run or something. So I was an extended adjournment. It was about 2 hours. So I remember driving in the car just back home, which, you know, is less than 10 k's from the court. And I hopped on an electronic exercise bike. We had a nice smashed out an average speed of 55 kilometres per hour for 20 minutes. That's like almost Olympic team sprint sort of stuff.
Yeah, but that's how much adrenaline you had and that you just couldn't get rid of if you didn't get on the bike.
Yeah. And now I can't do that because if I do that sort of level of training now and get that elevated heart rate and the sweats, what happens now with chronic PTSD is the amygdala in the brain's going, oh, you're sweating and your heart rate's up, job done. So it'll give me another hit of adrenaline. And cortisol, and so the adrenaline will push my heart rate up higher. So you risk having things like heart attack or a stroke, which I've had 3 emergency trips to hospital, twice for symptoms of heart attack, once for symptoms of stroke. And, it's pretty full on.
That would be an understatement. So you just said then, so you've got had 13 weeks off.
Yeah.
And you go back. And you've got 3 trials.
Yeah, 2 trials, a committal hearing, in basically in the second week back.
Like, it just defies everything. I don't know how you did it. But then
I remember on the return to work trip, the boss and the senior sergeant inspector picked me up from home to take me to the return to work thing. And I was presented with this court list because obviously a number of matters had been adjourned whilst I was off.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how the fuck am I going to do this? Mm. You know, and I actually cried. I thought, you know, in the meeting, I thought, anyway. So that, I did in that first week back, and but then I realised, no, mate, I sort of need to get out of this area. So and that's when the boss sort of said, well, you know, we can, how about you go and work in with Ken Lay for a bit with the other guys that from our unit that used to work with. So I went in 2008 and the first half of 2009, spent most of the time in the Victoria Police Centre. So doing project work for Ken Lay, who was Assistant Commissioner at that stage of Traffic and Transit. So doing and the reporting for the department, but also still looking at daily incident fact sheets of all the fatalities and briefing him on that, plus also in that time still receiving photographs and emails from my subordinates and other members of the unit, you know, that were seeking my knowledge and skills to assist them in doing their work. So even though you're not physically going out, you're still seeing incident fact sheets on a day-to-day basis with names of people killed, locations, places. Plus, you were still seeing photographic evidence of some of those coming through. And then in the you know, and in that time in the Victoria Police Centre working with Ken, you know, I had the committal hearing for the Kerang Rail disaster, which had occurred on the 5th of June of 07, where 11 people were killed on the train heading from Swanhill to Melbourne at the railway crossing at Kerang when the truck ploughed into the side of it. Yeah, so that committal was, you know, same thing again. I was all okay in the box, although obviously sweating profusely on the armpits, which people wouldn't necessarily see because you had your tunic on. But, yeah, as soon as the court, finished giving the evidence and you're standing there in the court with the families of 11 victims, it's pretty full on. It was very, very emotional time. And I remember eventually getting back into the VPC, you know, the next day or wherever it was. And Brett, one of the other guys I worked with in there, going, "How'd you go?" And, you know, same thing, just got all emotional. And, you know, and you look back on those things and go, oh, you know, that's all associated with the PTSD. Yeah.
So anyway. So it sounds like when you had that break, and you came back and you went to work with Whispering Ken, it doesn't sound like you really had a break at all, because you were being inundated with photos from your colleagues. And, I mean, I understand in a way your colleagues are asking for your opinion because, you know, you're an expert in the field. But in another way, I'm thinking to myself, what are they thinking? This guy is trying to have a break and you just can't have that break.
And some of the other things I did whilst in there, I was asked to set up a car crash reality display in Fed Square. Oh, so I did that. And that was involved with getting damaged vehicles in there, and then also, you know, getting relatives of, you know, car crash victims to speak. And I spoke. I remember speaking with Neil Mitchell. He had a caravan set up there at Fed Square. So I spoke with Neil, and, you know, and I remember one of the other ladies there whose child was killed in a fatality back in the early 90s at Manchester Road and Maroondah Highway that our unit had gone to. And she spoke as well, and I remember catching up with her at the Time for Remembering ceremony at Parliament House for Road Trauma Support Services last year, and it was a bit of a moving moment, because I'd seen her in that caravan talking to Neil that morning when I got emotional, and then saw her again. So it sort of brings back that emotional release.
Oh, look, you know, there is so much information that you have in that brilliant mind of yours. I could listen to you for days. I want you to come back, but I just want to go to a couple of things. How do you now manage your PTSD?
So effectively in managing PTSD, it's like managing the goalposts. The goalposts are anxiety and depression.
Yep.
So in terms of bringing those goalposts in, or those wavelengths in, I take medication for that element. So going back initially, when I first went to the Austin Repat Hospital to do the post-trauma recovery course, although you get there and they say you got PTSD or chronic PTSD, there is no recovery to this, but we'll teach you how to manage it. Okay, all right. So you think you're going to...
Thanks for that vote of confidence.
But they sort of say, yeah, look, this will be with you for ever in a day, but we'll teach you how to manage it and move on, which is, you know, and they explain how it all transpires, which gives you, once you've done that, it gives you an understanding of what's going on, because before that, you don't really know what's going on, but then you understand what's going on. So you prescribe medication, there's a lot of exposure-based therapy, cognitive-based therapies, psychologist appointments, psychiatric appointments. Then you, to bring those wavelengths in even further, you start to learn other techniques, things like yoga, Pilates, emotional freedom techniques, or the tapping solution, flotation therapy in float tanks, meditation apps, using apps like PTSD Coach on your phone to self-assess where you are at a given point in time. So what you're doing is actually monitoring where your levels are at, trying to bring those wavelengths of the height in depression in closer so that you can move on and function and achieve other great things in life.
I was talking to you last week in preparation for today, and you told me that you also have massage balls that are a great sense of comfort to you, and that you have them in the car so that when you're driving or you're about to drive and you're feeling a bit anxious, you use them. You're obviously very you're very busy with a whole lot of stuff, aren't you? Like, you've got your Fighting PTSD VicPol group, you're involved with Code 9 Foundation, Men's Shed. Like, you certainly keep yourself busy. Yeah.
And the golf club, modelling, and life-saving club. So,
do you do some modelling, do you, yeah, Pete?
Yeah, that's my sort of art. I could.
Well, yeah. Oh, aircraft modelling. Sorry, of course.
You're military modelling, so yeah. Yeah. So that's one of the things that a lot of veterans, they are doing is art therapy for mindfulness. And I used to do that a lot as a young fella, and then didn't do it for a while, and then got back into it in the early 90s and was pretty full on into the hobby. Probably till around about that time where Tony and
Rennie,
and then I stopped. I just didn't have the attention or concentration or the ability to sit down and do it anymore. I even got to the point where, I wouldn't go to the club meets. So you're socially isolating, which is not good. Mainly because the amount of devotion you were giving to the job was really tiring you out physically and emotionally. You weren't aware of it, but that's what happens. So you tend to isolate. You tend not to want to go out to social functions. You just bug it. You just want to sleep and recover.
It's almost funny how ex-cops, you still have that sixth sense, no matter whether you're a cop for a week or
veterans now.
I don't like to call myself a veteran, but we do have that sixth sense.
Yeah, you're still very switched on to everything that's around.
Yeah, you are, and you think that something or someone, it's just not something right. And we're always watching people, aren't we, what they're doing, where they're going. And I just wanted to finish with this. When we were talking about this, you told me about a situation when you were life-saving and the suspicious-looking guy on the beach. Can we close with that story? Because I think, bloody hell, we can't get away from drama. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, so it's 3 years ago now. On patrol, just up in the observation room, the lifesaving club. We actually had the beach closed because we'd had heavy rain and there was poor water quality. So we had the signs out saying beach closed, don't go in, because you've got to, obviously stormwater drain's got to go somewhere, and it comes out of the bay. So when it's like that, you shut the beach. And tell people it's not advisable to go in until it clears up again. But anyway, so I'm up. We got the beach closed, sent one of my young guys down onto the beach just to put the rescue tube and fins back on the board because they'd sort of blown. It was a bit windy. And I look out to the right towards Lagoon Pier, which is just the St Kilda side of Station Pier where the cruise ships come in. And a gentleman halfway on the pier, and he's got black jean trousers on, a white T-shirt. He's got the gold chain and the crucifix on. He's got a blue jacket on, and he's got a white bucket hat on with Australian flags on it. Skin was fairly dark on it. I thought, oh, he's pretty patriotic, but he was sort of like looked like he was signalling the Martians, and I'm thinking, we've got one here. Anyway, so I'm keeping an eye on him, and then next minute he's come off the pier and then down. I've sort of lost sight of him for a bit because of the sand dunes and the grass, and then he's appeared around the corner of where we would normally have the flags out on the patrol part of the beach, and he's all wet, so he's obviously been in the water, and he walks up to my young bloke that I had, you know, who was only like 15 at that point in time, on the beach, and flicks his patrol cap off his head, and I thought, what the hell, you know, WTF? Anyway, so I make headway downstairs, and I'm on the concrete on the beach side of the clubhouse, and then he approaches me, and he's right in my face, like he's like really invaded my personal space straight away, and he's in broken English, he sort of said, "Have you ever killed anybody?" And I said, "No, mate, I wouldn't want to." He said, "Have you got a gun?" And I said, "No, mate, I've just got me budgies and under the license." And he goes, "Well, I've got a gun." And it's at that point I looked down at the underneath the right lapel of his blue suit coat, which is wet from his being in the water, and it's sticking out. No, it's bulging out like the butt of a firearm sitting there. I thought, oh, you know. So I've immediately gone into your police training skills for gun grappling techniques. So I've just put my hand on there and holding it, and with my left hand, our club president, Brooksy, was up in the radio room, and I've sort of, with my finger on my left hand, done the 3000s, you know, and signaled to get on the phone. And unfortunately, he realised what was going on. And at the same time, I'm trying to keep everybody in the public out of the way, move them out of the way. And so, you know, I'm with this guy, you know, and he's just talking shit. He's off his face. And he grabbed the arm that I had on the butt of the firearm three times before, you know, police eventually arrived and twisted my arm up. But because, you know, when you're doing a fair bit of paddling on the rescue board, you know, you're pretty strong in the arm. So I was able to actually pull it back three times. Yeah, but eventually two police arrived and took him away. And then he was back 2 days later, and I'm going, what the fuck, you know, what's going on here? And he got arrested again, and then there was frequent reports of him harassing people up around Coles in Bay Street, Port Melbourne, and then lo and behold, one of the boys sends me a clip from Channel 9 News, and here he is at 8:30 in the morning a few weeks later, walking up and down Chapel Street waving a firearm around, and got arrested again, and that was the last I ever saw of him. So, yeah, don't know what I've been doing anyway. There you go.
Yeah, well, that just shows, you know, you can't stay away from it. It just sort of follows us, I think. But, look, Peter, thank you so much for today. It's just such a fascinating insight, and thank you for everything that you've done in relation to road trauma, because clearly it affects a lot of people, and that, as you said, that ripple effect. But thank you for everything you've done, and I hope, you know, life gets better for you. So thanks, Pete.
Oh, it's pretty good. I've managed it all right. But yeah, heavy shakes, but it's okay. Thanks, Narelle, and been great having a chat.
Hey, it's Narelle here again. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcasts as much as we enjoy putting them together. But to make sure you never miss an episode of Narelle Fraser Interviews, hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a rating and even a review. And please share it with all your friends too. And again, thanks for joining us. We have got some amazing stories to tell. So thanks again. See ya.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.